All right. Thank you very much for joining us tonight on the Unknown Strength podcast. My name is McGregor McNair, strength and conditioning coach. And to my right are my co-hosts.
Brenton McKitterick. I'm a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I have a passionate curiosity for the human experience and everything that it entails.
And I'm Steve Phillips. I'm also a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, and I'm passionate about coaching and self-defense.
Okay, so our aim with this podcast really is to contribute valuable insights and info about the fight sports and strength and conditioning, which translates to optimal performance in the cage, mat, or the ring. Our first guest on the Unknown Strength podcast is the one and only UFC middleweight, Dan Kelly. And we were very fortunate. We got him to take some time away from his hectic preparation and lead up for UFC 209, which is on March 4th in the US, March 5th in Australia, against former UFC light heavyweight champ Rashad Evans. It's going to be a massive fight, one of the highest profile Australian MMA fights ever. And without further ado, here is the interview.
No worries.
Okay, so thanks very much for joining us, everyone. We are here, Brenton, Steve, and myself, Mac, from Fitline Personal Training Studios, the Unknown Podcast, with a very special guest today, Mr. Dan Kelly. So thanks for joining us, Dan. Let me get this right. First and foremost, you're a four-time Olympian, UFC middleweight, a coach, a businessman, and a family man. Have I left anything out?
No, not really. Commonwealth Games representative for wrestling.
Ooh, there you go.
And a BJJ black belt as well.
Excellent.
Very nice.
Excellent.
So, just to throw a few extra things in.
Why
there.
Not? Absolutely. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got started in the martial arts, and a little bit about your journey to where you are today.
Yeah, sure. I started judo when I was seven. My dad's a fourth dan black belt in judo. He took me along, and I just stuck at it. I played footy as a kid as well. And then when I saw the Seoul Olympics when I was in grade five, I kind of went, it'd be really cool to go to the Olympics. And then by the time I was 15, I was starting to get a little bit more serious. I represented Australia for the first time when I was 16, won my first senior nationals in judo at 19, and then it all just snowballed from there. Was lucky enough to qualify for Sydney, and then just never stopped, went to four Olympics. Unfortunately, never quite got a medal, but finished top eight once. So was a long, hard road. I think all the training along the way has helped me with my other sporting endeavours after that. Mm-hmm. 2002, I went to Commonwealth Games for wrestling, and that was a really quick crossover. That was like a seven-month hiatus from judo. I was still competing in judo as well. I was national champion in judo and wrestling and Oceania champion at the same time, so I was still doing both sports. And then when I retired from London, thought I'd give MMA a go, and haven't looked back from there either. And that was, it's been a really good journey, and luckily now being in the UFC, it's reasonably financially viable as well, so it's not as selfish as a amateur sport where I'm actually taking money away from the family. It's actually bringing money in, which is handy, because I couldn't justify trying to chase Olympic dreams at 39 years old and taking money away from the family. At least every time I'm tired at home, we're bringing money into the family and trying to set ourselves up.
Absolutely. So let me just zoom in on something you mentioned earlier. You're a black belt in jiu-jitsu. Now that's a fairly new thing for you, isn't it?
Yeah, that happened maybe a month or so ago. Mm-hmm. It was a big surprise for me. I've been a brown belt for over a year, but I was a blue belt for about 8-9 years.
Wow. I know a few of those.
Purple belt for two or three. Then the brown belt and black belt came a little bit quicker. So that was a really nice surprise. Mm-hmm. I think by surviving a shoe face on my back for pretty much a whole round, Gustavo went, well, if he couldn't choke you out with he had his body lock and the triangle on, then
you kind of
deserve your black belt, which was nice.
Even that makes for a pretty tough grading.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was probably harder than the actual
trial
grading
by
we
fire.
Got.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And obviously representing Australia four times at the Olympic Games, That kind of makes you one of Australia's most decorated athletes. Do you have any kind of defining moments or experiences you could share with us about your judo career?
Yeah, I'm not the best one. My wife actually is. She's a 5-time Olympian, and she got bronze in Sydney.
Fantastic.
She competed twice for Hungary and 3 times for Australia, and she also fought for a medal in Beijing after we'd had our first child as well. So she's by far the best one we've had. Mm-hmm. Defining moments, finishing top 8 in Athens was my best result. Mm-hmm. One of the matches I won was against a Brazilian guy, Carlos Honorato, who was one of the favourites to win. He was a Olympic silver medalist in the last Olympics and current world bronze medalist. Mm-hmm. So that was a big win for me. It's probably the best result. And then obviously Sydney, the whole experience around Sydney was awesome. I finished top 10 in Sydney, which was okay, and I was only 22 at the time. That was an awesome experience, but yeah, it's the Olympic road seems very far away now from a competition perspective, but you just sometimes you sit back and you go, wow, I've actually done some stuff.
Yeah.
So it's not bad.
Does it make it far more insightful, I guess, when you're competing as an Olympian? You know, you're doing it for the love, you're not doing it for money, there's no financial reimbursement at the end or as much. So do you think that, I guess, that forges your mindset and that resilience, to use your pun again, when it comes to competition, because you've been competing and doing it for the love?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no, it's not a financial thing, it's you putting yourself on the line. I mean, I love competition. I wouldn't still be doing what I'm doing now if I didn't. But yeah, I think that hard-nosed attitude of trying to get better. And we're always, you know, I used to joke that, you know, Australian judo is like being part of the Jamaican bobsled team. You know? So being able to be competitive with those high-level, international, full-time athletes. I worked full-time. I worked a 45-hour week my whole judo career, just to get by, to save up, to travel when funding wasn't around. And I was reasonably well funded as an Australian athlete, but any time I beat one of those full-time athletes from Russia or one of the big countries, it was always a little bit sweeter.
That's a big deal, yeah.
You've got all this extra support, and I'm just a part-timer from Australia, and I can still match it with you. So that was always a good motivation as well.
Mm. That'll be my excuse from now on, competition as well.
Yeah.
Dan, how have you found the transition from athlete to coach? So with your experience in judo as an athlete, do you find that influences the style or the attitude that you bring to coaching at your academy?
Absolutely. Look, I've been coaching since 2006. I've now coached three sets of athletes to Olympic Games. In Rio, I was actually the head coach for the Olympic team. And while coached and athlete as well, I think the biggest change has happened in becoming a father. That's probably, and as the kids have grown up, my attitude's probably changed a little bit. I think I'm a better coach now than what I was maybe 5 years ago. I was probably a little bit too harsh and unforgiving with my athletes, and now it's more about setting a platform and an expectation for them to be able to go on their journey and be able to do it, because I can't hold their hand through the whole thing and program them completely like robots. It's more about, okay, this is the expectation, this is what we need to do, I can help set that for you, but at the end of the day it has to come from you, and that's going to make it more fulfilling for them, and also makes them a little bit more independent than potentially some of the other athletes I have in the past have been. So like you do as an athlete, you kind of evolve as a coach as well, and you get different influences and you have different thoughts, and as you get a little bit older, you change your approach a little bit.
So as a coach, do you have like a philosophy or a particular mindset that you subscribe to and in turn impart onto your athletes as a coach?
There's no substitute for hard work.
Yep.
And there's always got to be consistency. So if you work hard and you're consistent about what you do, that's a long way there. And that's excluding any of the technical side, any of the dietary needs, the strength conditioning needs. You have to work hard. And you also have to identify what an injury is, when you need to rest, are you just tired, can you push through? So that's all part of it. But yeah, the biggest thing is you have to work hard, you know, because the other guys working harder than you are. That's how you have to think. And if you do that, then you're always going to be honest about what you're doing yourself, and you can always front up and honestly go, I've worked hard and I've got every right to do this. Because combat sports are such a mental game that if you've got that self-belief and that reassurance in the back of your mind, it's always a lot easier going forward, because you actually have to beat someone else. It's not necessarily physically beat them up, but you have
you have to
beat another person in a game who wants to beat you. It's not like swimming where if I get these strokes right, my times are fine, I'll do this. Mm-hmm. There's so many variables, so ticking that box in the back of your head makes it a lot easier.
Absolutely.
So is that a call that you make for yourself, or like, for example, if you're feeling really beaten up, is there ever a point where your coach sits you down and says, look, I think you're really hurt, you have to sit out for this round, you have to take it aside, or do you make that call and you're saying, nah, fuck it, I'm fine?
Most of the time that one happens, so yeah. I'm pretty stubborn with that kind of thing, and I keep dragging. I have learned as I've gotten older, although I don't always subscribe to it, that rest is important as training, yeah. But
yeah, that's definitely a new age philosophy.
I'm not very good at following that. I look at it and I go, I've dragged my body through all of this already, and I'm still going, and I can still compete at a relatively high level. I don't know that changing too much will be good, particularly from a mental viewpoint. But I could learn to rest a little bit more, but we'll see.
Always future opportunities.
Yeah, exactly.
And rest when you're dead.
Exactly. You retired a long time.
Yeah.
So over the last few years, Dan, on the jiu-jitsu scene in particular, we've seen an explosion of new organisations, new competition formats, new rule sets. What are your thoughts around the future of judo?
Well, that's a little bit contentious. They've just changed the rules again, and they've just changed the rules again for kids in Australian judo. I don't necessarily agree, but I don't have any input or into those changes, so you have to adapt. Do I think the new international rules are good for judo? No. I think I could see a progression of what they were doing with the gripping, with the no leg grabs. I could see what they were doing right until they made the new rule change. That wasn't necessary. And now you're like, why are you doing that? Like, you've taken a few steps back on what you wanted to do. And so I don't agree, but if I stay involved in judo internationally, it's such a big organisation, and they stomp on anyone who has an opinion against them very harshly. Mm-hmm. So we just leave it a little bit. Yeah. It's very much like that.
I don't know if you've seen, obviously, a lot of the news circulating that judo athletes are prohibited from competing in events like Copa Podio, which is some pretty big events in jiu-jitsu. Obviously, in my opinion, I think that's that does hurt the evolution of martial arts in general to some degree. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
It limits judo athletes crossing over. So judo athletes crossing over to MMA now don't have any idea on how to deal with a sprawl. Luckily, my whole career was dealing with Russians grabbing at my legs and doing all that kind of thing. The new age guys have no idea on that. So their crossover is going to be much harder if they ever want to cross over to MMA. Yeah, their Greco game will still be good, but they won't know how to deal with freestyle wrestlers.
And more the ground judo, which you refer to as Niwaza. So.
Yes. Well, Niwaza's not too bad now because they're allowing a little bit more time, but that's an evolution as well. I mean, my BJJ judo, if you want to call it that, on the ground, actually going to Japan helped a lot because the Japanese work on modified guard and things like that. So learning how to pass guard and be heavy on top really helped going to Japan. Niwaza will be okay, but yeah, they won't get the opportunity to actually deal with the new style. And they'll still cross-train. I'll guarantee they'll still cross-train. They just won't be allowed to compete. And that'll detract. But the big, big countries in judo get so much money from their governments that they won't care anyway.
Right.
You mentioned about having had some good experience in dealing with the sprawl because of your exposure, perhaps to the European style of judo. So given that, what was the toughest part of your own transition into MMA?
Oh, the striking. Really, really hard. And to be honest, I'm still heavily criticised for that. So I had four kickboxing fights before I actually had my first MMA fight. And that helped a lot. But as you get to a higher and higher level, it's difficult. And that partially could be because I'm an older athlete. I came to it very late. But the striking and getting close into the clinch, the transition to that was the most difficult bit for me.
So Dan, having been myself at three out of your four AFC appearances and both Melbourne UFC appearances, I've kind of been watching your career develop, if you like. Although one of your early MMA fights I wasn't able to be in attendance at was the Dojo KO event.
Oh, yeah.
can you tell us about that experience and how the hell you can win by TKO thrown out of the ring?
So one of the rules, Dojo KO is on a raised platform.
Right.
So like a blood sport platform. And one of the ways you could win was by throwing your opponent out three times.
Right.
And that's how I won. I fought a guy named Ross Dallow who'd, by that stage, it had like five or six MMA fights, so it wasn't an easy fight. But
the White Devil?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. So that wasn't an easy fight to start with, but yeah, in the second round I managed to... Because if you went out with your opponent, then it didn't count. So yeah, and he was also a purple belt in BJJ at the time.
Mm.
Wow. So, and he was okay. Like he was a tough guy. So yeah, that's how I won. I ended up getting him out without me going out a few times. I think I threw him about 8 or 9 times in that fight. I took that fight on two weeks' notice. I had no idea what I was doing. It was a good experience. Hector Lombard was at Hangar 4 at that time. He's like, "Hey Dan, you wanna have a fight?" I'm like, "Yeah, okay. Why not? Come on, let's go.
So where was this event?
Was at the Hockey Center. Hockey Center, yeah, that was a long, long time ago.
How did that work at the Hockey Center?
Was just a race platform.
Just right in the center of the field?
Yep. No, so it was indoors hockey arena.
Ah, okay.
Just a race platform in the middle, and yeah, that was an interesting experience.
Got it, right, okay. So moving on from that, in this day and age, how do you feel about the need for young guys to be more controversial and... you know, getting more fights in Twitter and that kind of stuff to really sell their fights in MMA?
You got to understand that MMA, it is a sport, but at the same time, it's an entertainment thing too. It's a circus. And if you're going to stick your nose into that world, you're going to have to accept that that's the way it is. I mean, you look at Conor McGregor, everyone wants to be Conor McGregor, but yeah, I have to take my hat off to him.
Mm.
He's the biggest star now. He makes the most money. Ronda Rousey. She was very, very direct and blunt in what she wanted to do. She got what she wanted.
Mm.
She got the big money. And at the end of the day, it's a financial thing. I personally don't like it and struggle with it a little bit. Mm. Every second time I look at Twitter, some donkey's calling me out. Like,
you got to strengthen your hashtag game.
Yeah, ooh. Just leave me alone. Like,
yeah.
But that's how it is. That's the world I've decided to step into. So I have to accept that and you know, deal with it.
I mean, drama definitely sells.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the squeaky wheel gets greased.
That's
as simple as that.
Mm. So, what's your response to Eric Spicely's latest call out after his most recent win? Did you hear what he said?
Yeah. I couldn't even get my name right. He wanted to call me out. He's a liar to start with,
right?
Because he's been heckling me on Twitter for ages, and I've made two responses to him, and he's been back. Because when he gets on there, oh, he's been talking shit on Twitter. I'm like, yeah. And then they, in the interview, they said, "Oh, who started it?" He said, "Oh, I just don't like the guy. He just wanted to fight." A lot of these guys, they look at me and they go, "It's going to be an easy match."
Yeah.
And to be honest, I'm fighting a much higher profile, harder fight than he is and probably ever will be.
That's right.
I couldn't give a rat's ass about him. I'm worried about 3 weeks' time fighting Rashad Evans, and
absolutely,
that's all I care about.
Absolutely. And it seems to us that, like, in all of your recent fights, you've been kind of billed as the underdog, you know, certainly against Shoeface and Kamosi. Definitely up against Rashad, you're coming in as an underdog. What can you tell us about the psychology of going in as an underdog?
I don't care. Every UFC fight I've been in, I've been the underdog.
Yep.
So, and that's off the Vegas odds, and it doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bother me. It's, yeah, if you let those kind of things worry, you're a little bit too thin-skinned.
Got it.
I accept it. And if I'm underdog every time, that means I'm fighting guys who are better and better every time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a motivation for me. I don't really take that much. I think I'd be worried if I was a favourite going into something, because it'd be something odd.
So would you feel there's more pressure on you if you were the favourite?
Oh, I don't know, but it'd be, oh, well, that's a big surprise. Yeah, I'm used to the other side. So, yeah, it's happened so often now, it doesn't bother me at all.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you're really growing into that role.
Yeah.
Something I get asked a fair bit, and something I've explored a lot through my own jiu-jitsu journey And this is one that's always going to be asked, is how do you deal with competition nerves? It's something that crippled me from blue belt all the way up to brown belt. And even then, even every now and then, if I haven't competed in 6 months, I find I'm just, you know, tunnel vision, sweating, everything.
I'm a very nervous person. I retch before I fight. This in Melbourne, I actually vomited my breakfast up the morning of the fight. What you learn over time is you accept you're going to be nervous, you embrace it, as long as it doesn't impact on your performance. It's just part of the process and journey. I think now that I've been doing it for so long, and even my corner, they'd be worried if I wasn't retching out the back before I fought. They'd be like, what's wrong with you?
So how do you prevent it from impacting your performance? If it's, have you got to, you know, anything to sort of calm you down? Or
you rely on your process. So I'll listen to music, I'll do the warm up. If you just go, oh no, I feel sick, oh, I'm nervous. Yeah, I'm nervous. Yeah, of course I'm nervous. I'm about to walk out and get locked in a cage with someone and millions of people are watching. I'm nervous. I used to stand on the side of the mat at judo comps and in important matches and be retching. It used to drive my wife insane. It's, why are you doing this for? You look like you hate it.
Like it's a choice.
Yeah, and I'm, well, it's what I go through. So I think the biggest thing is accepting that you're going to be nervous. And that's how you deal with it. Not going, oh, I've got to work out a way not to be nervous. Just accept it. Yeah, I'm going to be nervous. It means something to me. I've just got to make sure I go out there, I've done the training, and work as hard as I can in the match. That's it.
I like that. That's a key takeaway, as long as it means something to you. Yeah,
it's good.
So I guess on that, I mean, mindset and competition mindset, something I'm incredibly fascinated by. For me particularly, competition's always been for me a platform to explore and better understand my own psychology and how I operate under stressful situations. One book I found particularly useful, something called Psycho-Cybernetics by Maxwell Maltz, explores the theme of the self-image and how you talk to yourself in a monologue. So on this topic, has there been like a book or a person or a particular philosophy that's really stood out to you and I guess inspired you and allowed you to have a more a sharper mind for competition?
I think it's just experience that's done it. I've always been very nervous. Like when I was young, my dad probably did a good thing. A couple of times I was sick, like going to a judo competition, so nervous, and he'd just pull me out and make me sit and watch. And then I'd be annoyed that I didn't do the competition. And it's just over time you get used to the experience. But self-talk's a big thing. In the judo competitions, it was always moment for moment, you know, push away what you've done, next thing. That's within the match. Getting up to the match, I'm a slow starter normally, so as soon as I can get through the first minute and a half, everything settles in. It's for me, it's when I fight in MMA, it's always just find the way, keep pushing, and that's all I ever think about. Everything narrows in, and it's good in a way, because in a fight, nothing else really matters for those 15 minutes. For that little block of time, everything else in the world's gone. You just got to concentrate on beating that guy. So it's a little bit I wouldn't like to say liberating, but I find it very easy because I don't really remember anything else after or around. It's just a fight, and luckily I can always hear my corner. That's a handy thing. So you're very focused on your job.
Yeah, excellent. In the moment.
Yes.
So I mean, that's something I've noticed from your fights in particular. For lack of a better word, it's, you know, you endure through all your fights, and you refuse to go down. I guess your will seems to carry you deeper into your fights than most others. You know, to quote Sherdog, Brian Knapp in particular, he described you after UFC Fight Night 101 as barely recognizable through all the gore. So you see plenty of fighters become either concerned or incredibly distracted. So how does that affect you in a fight? You know, if you're bleeding and literally, you know, seeing your own blood pouring all over your body. I don't know if you've seen the photos.
Look, I made a conscious. I was annoyed that he caught me with that elbow because I thought I was getting on top of him then. And I made a conscious decision after that I wasn't going to touch the cut. I wasn't going to rub the blood away from my eye because that draws attention to it for the referees. And even though it was a very high, it was pouring everywhere. And luckily in the round two, I took him down within a minute and a half of the fight. And so the blood was actually more of a problem for him because it was pouring into his face. Made it difficult for submissions and stuff because it was very slippery. But yeah, I just made a conscious decision. You're not going to touch it. Huh? You can see well enough to see him. That's it.
Yeah, it's his problem.
Yeah, his problem. He did it to me, so it's his problem. So.
Make him pay.
So I guess coming forward to the future fight, and we don't want to spend too much time talking about him, but What are your thoughts on the matchup against Rashad?
Oh, it's a massive opportunity. I remember him competing in the Ultimate Fighter Season 2 and winning, and then knocking out Chuck Liddell, beating Forrest for the title. He absolutely decimated Chael Sonnen, but Chael Sonnen isn't great at light heavyweight. He's pioneer. He's awesome. I've been a fan of his. And to get the opportunity to be able to compete against people who you've watched as a fan, because I'm still a fan of MMA. I love the UFC. It's just a massive opportunity.
So as they say, when your heroes become your rivals.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. Like it's a hard matchup. Got to remember, he's only 2 years younger than me. It's his first cut to middleweight. There's very stringent USADA testing now. And he hasn't competed in over a year, and he's only competed twice in the last 4 years. So there's a lot of pressure on him as well.
So speaking of that, is there any update on Rashad's medicals? Has he been cleared to fight?
Yep, been cleared. So what happened on Wednesday morning, I had to get up at 4 a.m. to listen in to a Nevada State Athletic Commission meeting. And so myself, Mark Hunt, Rashad all had to be present on the phone just to answer any questions they needed, and we all got cleared then. So it's official, the fight's happening.
That's awesome.
Terrific.
So that happened on Wednesday.
Great.
Excellent. So now, Dan, we we need to be respectful of your time commitments this evening. It's our understanding that you're reaching out, trying to gather support for getting some of your coaches over to Vegas. What can you tell us about that? How can people get in contact with you?
Best thing to do is to message my athlete page. Daniel Kelly athlete page. The UFC pays for myself.
Is that on Facebook?
Yeah, it's on Facebook. Sorry, yeah, Facebook. The UFC will pay for myself and one coach. Mm-hmm. And I've got two other corners, and because one of my corners, Gustavo's just had knee surgery, I need to bring someone else over as a training partner. I like to be as self-sufficient as possible, added to which, I mean, Rashad's going to be had red carpet rolled out for
That's
him,
right.
So it's a very important match, and obviously you'd hope that everyone back here is getting behind me. It's a big fight for Australian MMA as well,
sure
not just
is. That's right.
Not just, you know, in the whole scheme of things, you know, it's not many guys who've had the opportunity to fight a former champion.
That's right.
So it's all I want to do is cover the costs. I'm not looking to make $1 million out of it. Cover the costs for my guys to get over there and give me the best chance to, you know, win the fight.
I think at least for me, it put you on the map, and at least the jiu-jitsu world, because Shoeface is an incredible jiu-jitsu athlete. So for you to beat him, for me, that was ridiculous.
Yeah, he just beat Gary Thomas.
Oh, yeah, Flying Triangle.
Flying Triangle.
How about that?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know how many minutes you gave him on your back, but it wasn't enough.
No, yeah. It wasn't. Well, 4 minutes. Yeah, about four and a half minutes. I remember Gustavo almost pulling his hair out going, "It's the only place I didn't want you to be." But anyway, all's well that ends well.
Yeah, look, I mean, my own thoughts. I think if people weren't paying attention to you by that point, they certainly were afterwards. But if they weren't, then I'm not sure where they've been looking. Because although that might be a breakout match in terms of being in danger, you've been on the scene and at the pinnacle of Australian MMA for some time. So, you know, I'm sure that people rally behind the need to, as you called it out, like, it's just about giving yourself every opportunity to come and deliver to the best of your ability. And I think, you know, that's really important for us, not only as MMA fans, but as supporters of athletes, Australian athletes in sport.
So one thing I just wanted to ask, I mean, obviously the journey of MMA, it's not, let's be honest, it's not a very high-paying sport until you get to that top 5%. You know, in your mind, has there been any particular sponsors that have really, really supported you along that way, or even now, I mean, to make that possible? Is that something you have to depend on a fair bit outside of the financial reimbursement from the UFC?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got two main sponsors at the moment. We've got MA1 and Fight Life. They're the two main sponsors we've got. And Manto as well, so they're the main ones we've got, and obviously I still work full time at my gym as well. I mean, I'm doing okay. I'm not gonna die kind of thing. But
I'm not gonna see you in the corner of Burke Street.
No. But the big thing is as I come up against the higher level, more professional athletes, they've got a bigger support staff. It's very similar to my judo career. I just need to keep working and be able to be competitive with them, and then, you know, sky's the limit.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Well, we better wrap it up, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us today. Dan Kelly, UFC middleweight, March 4th, yep. UFC 209 versus Rashad Evans. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Awesome. Great.